Morning, everybody.
Morning.
I'd like to introduce our speaker today. She's not a guest speaker because she's been committed to practicing here for quite a few years. She's a priest in training here at Zen Center, Stacy King. She's been the chieftain for the last year. That means the person who's in charge of ritual. And starting July 1, she's going to be the big shot. She's going to be in charge of all practice. It's called the Eno. And so, welcome, Stacy.
Thanks, Tim. All right. Hello. Hello. Good to see you here. This is my first Dharma talk, and I thought, well, it's my first Dharma talk, so let's just jump right in there into the great matter, resolving life and death. And this, what I'm going to talk about today, I'm not going to talk very much about loss, although that is a way that we experience death. A lot of us come into contact with death as we lose people who are close to us or things that are close to us. But today I'm going to speak a little bit more about facing our own mortality and the clarity and the clearness that that can bring. So I've noticed in watching a number of first Dharma talks that how I got here story is appropriate. And I will do the same. Now, when I started at university, we were first assigned a how I got here paper. And the instructor wrote on the board that we were to do a high paper, H-I-G-H, how I got here. So this was a freshman acting class, and a good number of people took this opportunity to practice the great art of shameless self-promotion that was drilled into us in consecutive years of theater school. A number of other people took this as an invitation to get high and write the profundities of here and I and got and how. And I mention this because I want to say I'm sitting here, I'm giving this talk not as a proof of credentials or something I've achieved, and that, as far as I'm concerned, none of this has anything to do with some high, blown-out enlightenment experience. So the story, we'll do in media res, right, in the middle begin. In 2006, July 11th, 2006, at 5:17 p.m., I was in a subway wreck. The Chicago subway train car I was on derailed, scraped a car across the wall, caught on fire, and with about 500 other people, I was trapped in a smoky tunnel for about an hour. And we'll start by saying that this emergency situation created a great opportunity to experience the best of humanity. As we are all there together, undeniably, and helping each other out. People would call out to their friends down the line of passengers and connect each other. If there was a break in the rail or the platform in the darkness, as somebody found it, they would help others across. I also had an incredible experience in the tunnel. As we kept walking along. Occasionally, there'd be a stop, and you don't really know why. And at a point, I thought, if we don't keep moving, we are going to die. And then I lost my breath. And I thought about my aunt and my mom and the tent that they were shipping to me, and that it would stay in some shipping facility forever with no one to deliver it to. And I faded. I disappeared, just disintegrated into this smoke and darkness. And there was this, it was silent, so silent. Then somehow we were walking again and came up this weird staircase and out of the sidewalk into the light. There's a filmmaker I like a lot called David Lynch, and he, I heard him in a talk talking about these dark, dark characters that he creates. And he said that he does this because he loves seeing the people come out of the darkness and into the light. And so later, when people would ask me, you know, did you think you were going to die? I would say I thought I did die. I think that emergency workers, somebody might be able to confirm this, but I think emergency workers are trained to tell you again and again what happened, to orient you back to the light, to the breath and the air that you're in then. And so every person doing bandages or giving oxygen masks will keep saying, you were in a subway accident, the train derailed. And something was sorted out on those triage mats that this wasn't on purpose. You know, there'd been bombings in the London subway just a couple of weeks before. And they said, you were in a subway accident. And I could not believe that people would do this on purpose. And I, to this point, had led a pretty self-destructive life. And they say, the train derailed. You know, how could I hurt myself on purpose and create this fear and pain? There were weeks of scrapes and bruises, and I couldn't get the smell of smoke out of my hair, and months of not really being able to breathe, and this growing and growing fear just grabbing way down into me, until I really thought the city was just going to collapse in on itself. And so I moved to Iowa. That's what you do, right? yeah, I moved to Iowa and kind of went on about things. I didn't take care of my mind, my body very well after this experience. I just didn't know how or that was something that was available. So I went on, and I was in a yoga class in Iowa, and we took tree pose. And I've made speculation later about, like, why this pose or why then. And the thing is that it's a posture that is on one leg. And that leg has to be so strong and rooted down into the ground. So maybe I had some idea then that that the earth was there and that I was supported and that I could there start letting go a little bit. But really all I knew at the time was that I was freaking out. I started to cry in the class, and by the time I got home, I was not even able to get inside. I sat on the porch and I cried for really hours, and until I was just totally emptied out. Until there was nothing I could do except stare at the wall and breathe. So it came pretty naturally, right? And I'd had some experience with meditation from mostly an athletic yoga experience, but we'd do breathing exercises at the end of class. But this was something that I came to, like deep in my breath and really sinking into the ground, and maybe the ground of being is this elaborate phrase. And then my friend and I looked on the internet and we found out that this was a thing that people did. And this really just breathing and just sitting. We lived in a town where there were a lot of transcendental meditation practitioners, and that was so inspiring, and it continues to inspire my commitment because we knew what time they meditated, when they went to the domes there, and we did it at the same time. So we meditated 20 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes in the evening right away. And began to read more. We got a copy of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and I read it through a couple of times and then would often thumb through, you know, like an oracle, just looking for some excitement or encouragement. I read a lot of stuff on the internet, and I read Brad Warner. I read Sit Down and Shut Up in over the course of a few weeks in a bookstore in Iowa City. And there are a few things that this one book really brought to me, to my life, and I'm embarrassed how much this stranger really influenced me. So, but what do I want to say about that? Well, in Sit Down and Shut Up, Brad Warner wrote about the story of Dogen, who is considered the founder of the lineage that has led to MZMC, how we got here. And he wrote about young Dogen, I think 12 years old, at his mother's funeral, watching the incense fade into the air. And that at that point, at that young age, Dogen settled into this question of the great matter, this softening of the line between life and death as the smoke and air become undifferentiated. So I was interested in that. And Brad Warner also wrote about this subculture that I identified with this kind of punk culture, with the ideas that say, you know, deny authority and defy the dominant culture. You know, break apart the big lie that, you know, leads to oppression and war for the sake of power and for the sake of money. But there's another, you know, twist to this in that he offered that perhaps this could be done in stillness without so much of the angst and the anxiety and violence, righteousness of this anarcho-punk culture. And he wrote in a vernacular that was familiar to me, accessible, we say. So I knew I could have a part in this Zen culture, that it wasn't just for samurai or people's grandparents or this hobby of the leisure class, but it's something that I was really doing, and there were other people like me doing it. And hopefully now that more of my judgments have broken down around that, but it was very encouraging at the time. And this is something that has really stuck with me, and as I teach intro upstairs sometimes, I get to the third noble truth, that there is a path out of suffering, that there is a path out of suffering for everyone. This is the revolutionary thing that the Buddha taught. It wasn't just for the elite, but all of us can find some voice, some experience that opens that door for us. Okay. And here, right? MZMC, how I got here. I had intended to take a 6-month hiatus from my work in Chicago, and after a year and a half, I called the people I was working for and told them I probably wasn't coming back. And as we looked at mid-sized cities, we noted places that had a Zen center, were drawn to that, and moved to Minneapolis in February, which is like the punchline to a joke. And the first weekend that we were here, came to Intro to Zazen here at MCMC. And Ben, who's teaching now, was my first Intro to Zazen teacher. And then just kept coming, kind of coming here all the time. And it's maybe a little mean to say, but I really, really liked, just really appreciated that there was some place where I could go and be with people without having to talk to them. And, it sounds funny, but I'm really serious about it. We don't be together that way very much. We always have something to say. Sometimes we feel like we have to have something to say. But I did eventually start talking with some people. And this is 3 years after the wreck. Finally, then, started to say that this had happened. For the first time, walking around this lake with a friend, I said, this was scary. It was scary that this happened. So there is legend of a turning word. There's some thing that a teacher says to a student that turns them around and snaps open this enlightened clarity. But I did not want to talk to a teacher. I, from birth, really, was taught to not trust, to fear institutions, and especially religion. And you know, I didn't want to talk to this big boss man, Tim, but I was burning up with this trauma, and you know, just physically, emotionally, letting myself be tormenting myself with this replaying of the train wreck. And so at a point we were in retreat, and I went to Dokusan with Tim to, you know, face-to-face meeting. And I cried. There's a lot of this in that story. I cried. And then I said, I was in a train wreck. And Tim said, literally? So there you go. That was my turning word. And it was a turnaround because, I mean, there was this validation that was rough, right? Then we say that. We say this project is a train wreck, my life is a train wreck, when we mean that something's serious. And this was serious. Life and death, right? The great matter. And that he had to ask meant that it was not happening right then. That we're in a relatively safe place. There was no fire. I wasn't trapped. So even as I tell this story, we're having a train wreck, we're having an experience of this story, but we're in a relatively safe place, and it's not happening right now. So what was happening is I was, you know, in this relatively safe room with this creature who had practiced for years and years and years. In this practice, I could feel that opening, the big, big heart and the ability to hold that stillness in such a way that I could open to my own suffering. Now, I want to take a big tangent here because I think it's important to say that I also visited a number of psychological professionals during this time, and you know, did therapies and trainings, and I do think it's important to mention because Zen and therapy, in my experience, have complemented each other in this way of examining the self, but it's not the same thing. Like, trying not to cry too loud in a quiet room is not meditation, and this trauma, mental disturbance, difficult relationships, they're going to arise as we're sitting. But meditation, Zen, has no interest in solving problems. And sometimes, to function, we need to solve problems. So we can do both. And as I sat, and the trauma response returns and faded and returned and faded, and just burned away. I can't identify the point at which it burned away. But we must go through the fire. There's not a way around. There's not a way of avoidance. For it to burn away, we must be right in the middle of the fire. Now I'm in this position where, out and about, anywhere, I get questions, big questions, and usually phrased as, what do Buddhists think about whatever? What do Buddhists think about carrot popsicles or life on Mars or something? And I'm confounded by this, that I should be able to answer this question. But I've come to have dogma available. Because, I had this big experience, and I needed religion. And the only dogma I could really deal with was nothingness. So I can say all these things. So I can quote Brad Warner, quoting Nishijima, translating Dogen, who probably studied some Buddhism. So this is what Buddhists think about life and death. And there's, this is from Soji, a fascicle by Dogen. And there is some more conceptual piece, that extinction is moment by moment, and we can delve more deeply into that in further conversation and study group. But Dogen too gets to the point. In the time called life, there is nothing besides life. In the time called death, there is nothing besides death. Thus, when life comes, it is just life. And when death comes, it is just death. So in my lived experience of this question, when I question life and death, in the aftermath of the train wreck, of course there was this incredible revelation that we could die at any moment. And that's something we can understand and something we can sometimes find an unpleasantly deep knowledge of. And in this, there was moments of... I was just stunned with the overwhelming beauty of life. And there was times in the traces of pain and confusion where I wished I did not get off that train. And while one of these maybe is more pleasant than the other, maybe... They're both kind of ridiculous. To want life or to want death, we have nothing to do with it. So what I can do is practice breathing completely, study completely, work completely. So dead, alive, whatever state I find myself in, I'll just be able to do that completely. You know, right here, right now. Just all sink back into this room together. We're doing it right now. We're here right now. All the ways that we all got here. That's the great matter, right? We're doing the great matter right now. I think that is all that I want to say right away. I'd like to hear from you, too, if you have questions or comments to this. Oh, yes.
Stacey, I found your timing impeccable. Today is National Cancer Survivor Day. So any of us who have dealt with that, who have been through that trauma, and are not trying to figure out what is the great matter. So thank you.
And thank you, too. Who's here?
I think there's been, or my therapist has mentioned some recent studies about trauma, and that sometimes, like, talking through it right away and over just makes it be relived in a way and re-traumatizes the person who has a trauma. And I guess I'm wondering, because it felt like from your story, you were able to sort of create a sort of like stable footing before you started talking about it. And I'm wondering if you think like without that stable foundation first, you would have been able to continue to talk about it, or I don't know what you think that effect that's played. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. I do get that, and I can see that, you know, at the time and in the months when I was still in Chicago, especially, I mean I wasn't dealing with it well anyway, but I also didn't have the support or means to face it. And I think that the practice, doing zazen and knowing that I was safe as long as I stayed still and kept breathing, and that there wasn't really as much risk, and that I had great support in the sangha and in Dharma, Buddha, and Sangha, that you know, what I was reading and you know, the essence of awakening coming into me, and I guess the way I would put it is that the practice helped me open up to acceptance in general, and then in that, I was able to deal. Yes.
Is it traumatic to talk about the experience now? Or revisit it in your head?
No, not at all. Right now, this time, the details get a little washed out as you tell a story a number of times. So I know this story, right? And in this here, I'm going to avoid traumatic detail anyway. So I hope that what I have to say is helpful. And so that's why I tell the story now, and it isn't as entangling as it used to be.
Was part of the trauma that you were had this somewhat analogous to yoga experience where you were seeing the evanescence of your own life?
I think that was well, right now, as I think of it, it's actually a more supportive piece of it. I think the trauma was the the details that aren't worth to going into. The way people were hurt and people were scared, and it sucked. It was a bad place to be. Yeah. What is in my book? I don't organize verbally as well as visually, and so I have like a comic strip here that tells me where to go next. Yes.
That was going to be my question. So I'll go ahead and move on to my second question, which is my understanding of interaction with you about the word is that you were a little bit surprised that your trauma wasn't evident to everybody around you. Is that a correct way to read that, or is there something else that I should understand about that story?
Very much so. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. That I couldn't. It was so big to me. I couldn't imagine that anybody else just didn't know, or I felt I didn't want to tell anyone. You know, it's silly, right? I didn't want to tell anyone. Like, I'm ashamed I got in a train wreck, and then, but I also felt weird if people didn't know because it was so big to me. And that was a piece of it. The other piece was just, it was like, wake up, you're not in the train. Right? That's not what's happening here. Yeah, Susan.
Stacy, I'm so moved by your story and how you told it, and going from, it strikes me that your process of becoming more conscious of what you said at the end, that we're right in the middle of life and death right now. We're all together, we're in right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that maybe we know that at some subconscious deep level. We know that, but not without knowing the terms, the technical terms. We're just living it, like babies who are just so present.
Mm.
And yet, they're certainly not mature, they're not under control of their bodies and speech and all that. So they have to go through all kinds of life experience in order to get to the point where they're fully integrated and can communicate with others, etc. And there's some kind of parallel there that I appreciate about your story. Just moving from the life before and then the life after, and integrating all of the teaching and practice in that. Very helpful. Especially your last word. We're right here doing it. And we're not feeling afraid right now. At least I'm not.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Going off the reference to these are survivors today, talking about your trauma and people having their own traumas.
Mm-hmm.
This idea that you were here for a while and talk to people, similar experience of segmenting people for a while on whether they knew about my trauma or not. They didn't know there were these circles. But they were there in my head. So I was wondering if you experienced that and felt that expand, sort of visualized it that way.
I certainly, for a time, I can identify that I only told a few people, talked to a few people about it, and so, in that time, there's this sense of secrecy. I think that it expanded into these circles. I get what you, and it expanded into that as I began to tell more people or tell pieces of it here and there. But then if I was in a mixed group, I felt like people would say, oh, here she goes again, talking about the train wreck. And then other people, don't know that this happens. And want to wear a sign or hide or,
I guess I'm not talking about therapy yet. But at some point I was told, you don't have to do that. You don't have to create these circles that people don't even know they're accepted into yet.
Mm-hmm.
You can be more open than that.
And in a lot of, not always, but a lot of times sharing our suffering is a gift. As I told the story, Rosemary said to me, everybody has something. Everybody has something. And as much as it's helpful, if I can share my story and share my suffering, then I, invite others to as well. And we can come together with that, best heart toward each other. Like sitting in silence and not talking to each other. Maybe engaging with each other in a way that is substantial and taking that risk to do that. Hey. Hi.
I wanted to say thank you. Thank you. You're sharing your story is really profoundly great. I'm particularly interested in seeing your drawings at some point. I really appreciated something that was pointed out, the visual element of your story. And I'm feeling it very strongly in the images of darkness that you have, and kind of formlessness, and rooting yourself in the tree pose, and the light, and that realization that you are not in that moment anymore, experiencing trauma, it's drawing a lot of connections for me personally about what meditation has meant, and that not problem-solving kind of way of snapping into the present, and how frequently I think that people can be stuck in these different places that are not this moment. So I appreciate you sharing your story about coming to the now and coming through so much in the light.
Thanks. So let's close up here, and I'll stay back on the porch. I'll put this out on the counter if you want to see it. and we can talk some more. And I also encourage you to talk to each other, and you take this question: what is something that spoke to you along the way, a writing or experience or a person? You know, what is your story? How did you get here? Good. And Karen, would you give us some announcements, please?
I'd love to.
Excellent.